We're making our way through a journey known as the seven purifications. I'd prefer to think of it as the seven simplifications. And I like to think of it as a journey home. I'm not sure what home, what associations all of you have with home. But for me, home is a place where maybe some of the greatest sense of ease, safety, but also a place where we let go of being self-conscious. It's a wonderful thing to put down being self-conscious, just to be as you are. And if it's not, that kind of home is not in a house, some people find it other places, perhaps in a place of nature, or perhaps in meditation, or perhaps together with certain people who have somehow bring that for us. And, you know, in Buddhism it's kind of popular to give a lot of these things grand terms. Big names, big words. It's a path to enlightenment. That's a pretty big word. But if instead we think of it as a path of simplification, path of coming home, home to ourselves, it's also a way of becoming ordinary. Ordinary in with a particular flavor of who we are. We don't have to be anybody special. Don't have to attain anything special. Don't have to have a Buddhist merit badge to show how special we are. To be at peace with ourselves in an unself-conscious way. To be ordinary in the way that each of us is ordinary. And so there's this journey from A to B. And I think of this journey in a variety of ways. One way I still see it as a shedding, and that there's kind of like concentric circles, and that we're going from the outermost concentric circus, yes. The outermost circle, or the most centrifugal force, maybe the most distant from our hearts, perhaps, widest orbit. And then we are steadily making our way closer in, coming in to what's more intimate, more immediate, more here. In some ways, in a wonderful way, more personal, more connected here. So it's a journey into the center of our lives, center of ourselves. And in that sense, we're not going anywhere. But we're arriving where we are, but right in the middle of it, and not being out there in the outer orbits of our lives. So they say that the fastest way in practice to get from A to B is to be fully at A. To be really here with what is here. and then discover what's here, but to kind of really settle into what's here in deeper and deeper layers. And this is one of the gifts of doing interviews, practice discussion with Upandita. In fact, it's one of the important ways that he taught was the ways in which we had to report in the interview. And so if we came into the interview with him and said, "Oh, I had such a hard day today, it was really tough, and I had a lot of, you know, I didn't know if I could make it, and, you know, this is very much like, you know, what it was like in high school when the teachers were really strict, and I just didn't feel like I was up to it," and something. The eyebrow would go up. And that was probably the end of the interview for that day. That was, in its way, it's maybe an accurate enough story, but it's a story within a story within a story, or it's a story housed in bigger stories and bigger stories. So, you know, there's part of the big story is me, myself and mine. And when we kind of the story of our life, the story of me, story of what's happening to me, my whole life, what happened in high school, and, you know, in Burma, decades after high school. So what you could come in and say, I sat down to meditate, and immediately I felt a heavy weight, a sinking feeling. I noted it as heavy, as sinking. I felt it in my shoulders, in my belly. As I felt it, I could feel it, I could recognize there was discouragement. It's a familiar feeling, I know it from before. And I kind of went in and really noted the discouragement for a while, and as I did so, my attention was drawn to the heaviness in my shoulders. I felt the heaviness as weight. I felt it in particular points of weight, areas of my shoulders. And as I did so, the weight got stronger. As I got stronger, I noticed that the sense of discouragement got stronger, and I noted it as I was noted it as getting stronger. And then I noticed that the weight seemed, my attention shifted from the weight, because what became more compelling was a strong sense of vibration and tenderness in my chest. I brought my attention to that and felt that. And I felt how it was changing and shifting as I watched it. And as I was felt it and noted the tenderness and vibrations and tender in my chest, it decreased, got softer. And as I got softer, I felt calmer. And the heaviness in the shoulders was no longer there, the discouragement was no longer there. At that point, I became aware again of the rising and falling of the abdomen. And Upandita might say, "Carry on." The eyebrow wouldn't go up. Like, that was like the most praise you can get, was "carry on." But learning to report that way was such a wonderful corrective for many of us practitioners, myself and others that I knew, who were so wedded, so committed to the story of me, myself, and mine, seeing it through a very big filter, an overlay, a projection of what it meant to be a self and self-identity issues and our relationship to other people and the stories of our life and what we needed and what should happen and who we are and our value. And, you know, it gets more and more complicated. Layers and layers and layers of this stuff, self-consciousness, which can seem, you know, it's appropriate in certain settings, in certain situations of life. It's not to say this is not unimportant, this part of life. But sometimes that whole story-making mind, the self that we do, is a teeny bit in certain people, maybe, overrated. And it wouldn't, you know, be so damaging to kind of come in closer, not in that outer orbit. We think it's really who we are, but it's spinning of the stories and ideas and histories. And so he wanted us to come closer in, closer into A, to here, to home. And so the way he trained us was to, we had to report that way. And if you had to report that way, you had to experience yourself that way. So if I'm sitting there thinking, oh wow, I'm so discouraged and I wonder why, oh yeah, I think it has a lot to do with high school and he said, she said, and now I understand, maybe. But then she got angry at me and you know, then I didn't get invited to the prom and what was that about? And I never get invited to proms. You know, maybe those things are true, but it's kind of, again, it's kind of staying away. It's kind of like, it's kind of, in a certain way, kind of disconnected from what's really here. Really here. Have you ever been angry at someone? And felt like you were justified to be angry, and felt connected, and this is, you know. And then you found out that the reason you're angry doesn't exist. They were late for an appointment. And this is the third time they were late for a meeting. And self-right, you're upset and angry. And how could they do it? It's disrespectful. And then you found out that they actually came early, waiting there. But they got hit by a car standing on the sidewalk. And they're in the hospital. So suddenly the story you made up around how they disrespected you being late was an outer shell, a projection, an idea that had no reality to it. It was made up. You couldn't even put your finger through it. It's not even there for that. So the idea is interviewing Upandita was just coming in, coming back, really, what's here? What's here? What's here? What's the experience like? And, you know, in that example I gave, you know, I was feeling discouraged, perhaps, and there was a way of noting it and being present for it, where I wasn't sinking under weight, I wasn't feeling sorry for myself for doing it, having been discouraged or lost in it or caught. I was just in a certain kind of maybe dignified way, balanced way, just showing up for it and seeing it, looking at it right in the eye. This is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. Here. So this idea of coming home and being here, more and more close in these seven different stages. And today we come to the fifth step, fifth purification, that has is made up of grand names, powerful names, Buddhist names, Indian names. In English, it's knowledge and purification. No, knowledge and vision, purification by knowledge and vision of what is and is not the path. It's a mouthful. You don't have to remember this, but I want to just talk about these words a little bit. Knowledge, jnana, at least in the Buddhist context, is not just ordinary knowledge that you learn in a book, but has to do with what you really experience, knowingly experience, in such a way knowing this frees you from your self-consciousness, frees you from your attachments, frees you from clinging. So it's an experiential knowledge that's freeing. Dasana is the Pali pronunciation of a word that some of you probably have heard in English, in the certain Indian religious scenes, darshan. Darshan is a particular way of seeing, and you look upon sacred things. You have darshan because there's something powerful in what you're seeing that somehow gets transmitted to you. And I think the most common modern Indian kind of thing in Indian certain religious groups is having darshan with a guru. You go just be with a guru. You have darshan. You're in that realm and in that relationship. Here, it's dasana rather than darshana. And dasana means vision, to really see. And not exactly we're seeing the sacred, because in a certain way, either Buddhism has no sacred, or everything is sacred. I think we kind of don't get to, we only get those options. Everything else is kind of sacred. But that's... And so to have darshan, to really see this reality, to see in a deep way what's here, is such a significant thing. It's a religious act to see. So that's what we're doing. Vipassana is to see clearly. And then path. The word is magga or marga in Sanskrit. And it's probably the word that, one of the words that most qualifies to mean religion. If we had to translate some Indian religions to English, because originally they never had a word for religion. And so there's different margas. There's the Buddha's marga, magga. So it's a path, but it's a very significant path. It's a powerful path. It's a meaningful path. It's something that, it's not just strolling down any old path. When people discover the path for themselves, it's life-changing. Some people, that change in life is manifested in going for refuge. This is the orientation that I want for my life. This is what I realize. I know something now that's so significant and so applicable to all areas of my life that I want this to be the basis of my life, this path. And the idea of a path is also this idea you're going somewhere. It's an ongoing journey. It's not a done deal. And I find the idea of an ongoing path towards freedom, to the end of suffering, to the end of distress, and a path to liberation and compassion, this movement and this growth that we're capable of, and to walk that path, profoundly meaningful. And so it comes a point where a person has their own sense, their own vision, experience, knowledge of what is and is not the path. That's where we come to in these stages. So to explain this particular purification, I think it's probably good to go back a couple of steps to purification of view and kind of see how it develops. So as we get settled here, concentrated, then at some point the mind is strong enough, clear enough, things are settled enough that we can distinguish between the experience we're having and the knowing of it. And there's other ways of experiencing life that doesn't have that sharp distinction, but it's a natural distinction that the mind makes. A natural distinction of life itself. And under certain circumstances of being settled, calm, concentrated, when we've shed a lot of the ideas and stories and concepts and for the time being shed ideas of the past, the future, we're not involved in reflective thinking, just reflecting back on what just happened 5 seconds ago. We're not anticipating what's going to happen in 5 seconds or 5 minutes or something. But we're here with the experience right here as it's occurring. And so it becomes more acute or more clear what's happening in the present moment then. We're here for it, in the way that we're not if we're in a story or something like that. And so there can be a sound, some new sound, and the sound arises, and there's a clear that the mind somehow or other registers that sound, knows that the sound is happening. So, for example, if there was suddenly now in a quiet meditation center, and suddenly there was just a lot of ruckus sound out in the foyer, in order for my attention now to be concerned what's out there, something in the mind had to know that I heard that sound. That had to register somewhere. So something you can feel. There's a sound. Oh. And then there's the impulse to listen to it, and the mind goes kind of in that direction. What's that? And I'm there kind of to know, what is that sound? But is it clear that there's the sound itself is one thing, and the series of mental events that follow that sound are distinct from that? Because there might be a sound that's kind of, maybe it's been happened a number of times. You've gotten used to it here in the hall. And it happens again, and you hear it, but it doesn't really do much in your mind. If someone later asks you, did you hear that rustling? Yes. But there wasn't this clear, you know, taking a moment to know it. But if I go like this, I suspect that part of you took time to really know that sound. And so they're very different than if there's a little rustle in the room and, you know, you didn't really take it in. So as we settle down in the sitting and take the time and the willingness to just be with the experience, each one kind of as it occurs, and know it, sense it, feel it, what it is. One of the things that's very important, especially people who do mental noting, is to not do the checklist approach to mindfulness. The checklist approach is, it's all about the noting. And if you note it, you're done. Done that one. Go on to the next one. Check it off. In-breath, in, rising, falling, check, you know. It doesn't really matter that, you know, you're not really interested in what the experience is like because you just want to get your checks done. And so it's, but you don't want it a checklist approach to mindfulness. You want to know it. Really be there for the experience. And it means you can't be there for all the present moment experiences, but you're there for what is salient or dominant or, you know, where you've made your anchor or whatever arises that's, you know, compelling. And you try to meet it with a calm, relaxed, full mind. What is that? And then as we get closer to it and really there for it, one of the things that we become aware of is that things are changing. In a variety of ways they change and move and come and they go. And some people have sometimes more acute experience of how things arise and pass than other times. But it can be a little more interesting, because if there's a feeling of pressure, at that point, it's possible to have the knowing of the pressure. If you release the pressure, in a certain way, the knowing of the pressure is not there. Say it a different way. In your direct experience, of what you can directly know sitting here in this room, that you can touch, see, smell, hear, really kind of that kind of direct kind of hear. Is there an IRC kitchen in your direct experience? No. It doesn't exist in your direct experience. Does what happened in high school exist in your direct experience? No. Is what you're going to have for supper in a little while, does that exist in your direct experience? No. So the question is, what really exists in your direct experience? So when I put my finger on my thigh and push and have pressure, at that moment, the feeling of pressure exists. If I release my pressure, my finger, that particular pressure has vanished. It no longer exists, except as a memory. So as long as I'm pushing on the thigh, only then can there be the knowing in direct experience of the pressure. It's very special, that knowing what's immediate and direct. And it only exists as long as I'm pushing. When I release, that knowing doesn't exist because it depends on what's happening in the moment. So the knowing of that pressure can only occur with their pressure occurring. And the knowing of that pressure stops, disappears with the release of the pressure. The knowing comes and goes with the coming and going of the pressure. However, many of us, I mean all of us, I suppose, can have such a habit to kind of be living not in the direct experience, but in the more abstract concepts, ideas, the meaning of it, the story of it. So I can push here, my thigh with my finger. And now I know the pressure directly. And then I start thinking. You know, this is kind of nice to have this little pressure. Nice. I wonder if I should take up acupressure. And maybe we should train all the people here at acupressure so that we can do this wonderful kind of acupressure during retreats. I think that'll be great for our retreats. And I think it'll be fascinating. And I wonder, they must have classes in Santa Cruz. And I wonder if I could sneak out at lunch and start the course. And that was really great. And that pressure, having that pressure so good. And that was so wonderful. And I can imagine having more of that tomorrow. And the pressure's long gone. I released my finger. It's not there anymore. I'm talking about a virtual reality. I'm no longer connected to direct experience. I'm in the circus. So what we can directly know, really know, as real in our direct experience, can only be known with direct experience. And it comes and it goes with experience. And so that's why we say sometimes in this practice here, don't bother with retrospective thinking. You might have blown it in mindfulness sitting here. When you know it, no point thinking about what happened. Just show up for the next thing. It's so forgiving, this practice. Just show up for the next thing. It doesn't matter what happened five seconds ago. Show up for this, because we keep wanting to come back to the direct experience of now. That's where the path is. That's where we find something. So there's the experience, and there's the direct knowing of it. The knowing arises and passes with the arising and passing of the direct experience. However, the knowing itself has its own dynamic, and that also can shift. So say that what's happening is my knee is aching, and so there's ache arises, and I know it. It doesn't go away right away, so I know it, and I see it kind of as a different dance. And while I'm knowing it, the knowing itself moves around a little bit around the knee. Or there's a loud sound, and the knowing knows that for a moment, and then I'm back to the knee. Or then I feel, you know, there's a feeling of tightness in the knee, and the knowing stays with that. And rather than that tightness necessarily going away, sometimes the knowing itself, because the knowing itself is coming and going, actually moving and doing its own dance, is now going to feel the heat of the knee rather than the tightness. So it's also shifting the knowing. So these two things are kind of in relationship to each other, and they're kind of shifting and moving. So sometimes we are focusing on the object of what we know, but sometimes you can settle back and relax and also just watch the dance between them. And sometimes it becomes clear that you're not in the picture. Meaning that it's not you doing the knowing. Something happens. Body feels warm, and you see, and you notice that when the body is warm, then there's knowing of the warmth, the recognition of warmth. But it happened kind of spontaneously. It wasn't like you decided to know it. It was just the knowing happened. And so this is kind of what Brian was talking about yesterday, of this conditionality, dependent arising. That something occurs, there's an event, and the event has a result, has a consequence, or has an impact that is not really explained by you as the agent. It's just the way the mind works. And it can be quite a relief to see that there's no self in this equation sometimes. There's a loud sound outside, and the mind goes to notice what that is, before you even had a chance to self-consciously think about this good idea, should I or shouldn't I? Just that's what it does. And so we start seeing this wonderful kind of relationship between the mind and the body sometimes. There's a thought, and not only is a knowing of the thought, but you can, as you know it, you see that in having that thought, maybe the jaw gets a little bit tense. Thoughts are not innocent. So look at that. There was no you in that experience. It just seemed to be, you know, you didn't plan or engineer that to happen. There was a thought, and there was a consequence or an impact. Look at that. And as we settle into the direct experience more and more, this wonderful, get more interested in it, kind of connected to it, we start seeing that variety of things, seeing and knowledge and vision. We start seeing that some of what we're aware in direct experience is changing, is inconstant, is comes and goes. And some things which don't seem to go as fast as we'd like them to go, if you bring your attention really close to it, really present, you see that it's made up of inconstant little elements or sensations that are dancing into existence and out of existence. Like the example of the knee hurting. I find it fascinating sometimes to have a painful knee. I won't sit with a painful knee if I think I'm going to injure myself, but, you know, sometimes not. It's not going to be injurious, and I kind of feel the pain. And if I hold it at a distance, if I'm way out in the outer orbit of this all this stuff, oh, gee, here we go again. I hate this pain. It's so hard. Why did I do this for my vacation? And you know, I'm not up to it, and it's just life is so not fair, and my knee hurts. Upendita's eyebrow would have gone up. what's the direct experience? Because all that little litany was not a direct experience. What's the direct experience? Sometimes I've gone into the knee to feel the pain, and I'm surprised that when I'm really there for it, it's not such a big area after all. A square inch somewhere. And it feels pretty solid and unchanging. But then I get closer and closer, really feel it carefully. And it feels like it's just kind of sparking sensations. All those little things. Little heat, little pulling, little stabbing, little pain. You know, it's kind of like coming in and out of existence. Like a little dance in this little square inch area. Wow, it's not solid. It's made up of all these little momentary sparks of sensations. So many of the things that we experience in direct experience, if we're not thinking about them, if we're not putting labels of concept on top of them, and really feeling directly, start getting into, wow, things are changing all the time and in constant. And so many of these things that are happening, there's no self in the experience. The self is not really in the equation. I'm quite capable of bringing the self along and inserting it. But I've been doing that for a lifetime. It didn't really get me very far. I think that I'll try Upandita's way. I'll give it a try, just a little bit. I'm going to have probably many years more to insert the self. Maybe I'll take the risk or try the experiment or to try to, let's not have the self involved. Let's just see what's operating here. And it might be possible to see that there's a degree to which things are operating where you kind of don't see a self operating. It's just cause and effect phenomena going on. It's a fascinating movement of things. And then also it can be seen that things are unsatisfactory, or there's a kind of suffering or dukkha or tension or something that doesn't quite, you know, something that a little bit feels, I don't know, kind of not quite right. In getting actively involved with any of this stuff, moving towards or away from or reacting to or holding on or pushing away, that it's not very satisfying to have this kind of always this ongoing relationship of preferences and wanting and fixing and getting and holding and planning and all this. And it just feels better to leave it alone. Just let it be. So at this point in this, as we get into this, you know, we're developing mindfulness, but we're developing mindfulness together with concentration, meaning we're really trying to stay with our direct experience, stay with what's happening, stay with the anchor, stay with the things that are happening in direct experience. And the same kind of process begins to happen as would happen when someone does regular straight concentration practice. One of the things that begins happening is that the mind's tendency to think about other things and have discursive thoughts and conversations and review the past and review the future begins to recede into the background. And what's interesting, where the focus is on what's happening in the present moment, the hindrances begin to relax and fall away. The hindrances of desire and aversion, sloth and torpor, regret and resentments, worry, doubt and uncertainty. That these activities and forces of the mind begin to abate so that we can get more really here for the experience, just here. And some of the momentum of concentration of just, it just feels good. You know, kind of like we're kind of like on track. It's kind of like we're beginning to feel a little bit like, you know, you've been going up a mountain for a long time, hiking up, and now you've come to the top, and now there's a gradual path down, and it just now feels easy to walk because gravity is kind of helping you. Your steps are a little bit longer, you can kind of, you know, you feel a bit lighter, and you kind of like, you know, just like you're, and then the hill gets a little bit steeper, it's a little bit easier to go down, then you can, so there you are. And then there's a sled, and you slide down. You know, you're on the sled, you know, and just and so because when people, you know, get kind of concentrated with the mindfulness into this world of direct experience, really can rest there and focus there, trust it, trust putting aside all the other things and just being with the flow of direct experience. They're getting concentrated, having a mind being collected and unified and engaged, things start feeling pretty good. And it's not uncommon for people at this stage to begin feeling that they want to sit much longer. The bell rings in the sitting and they're not really ready to get up. It feels like, I'm just like beginning here. I'm really, you know, it's moving here. I'm connected or I'm engaged. And so the people sometimes will sit longer and as the momentum is there. Often because of partly the concentration and partly because of all the usual self-consciousness and sense of self falls away and concern, there's not very much pain or discomfort anymore. The body starts getting mellow and softer and more open. And that wonderful feelings of well-being, of joy, and begins to well up much as part of the practice. So here, a number of things can occur, which are called, that's a wonderful name, all these names. So if the whole point is to have insights, then there are the defilements of insight. And these they're a great list, the defilements. They must be really bad. And so here's the list. Luminosity, knowledge, joy, tranquility, happiness, faith, resolve, mindfulness, equanimity, and longing. I mean, what? These are defilements of insights? I thought this is what I was practicing for. I thought the whole point was this is where I was going, you know, and now you're telling me they're defilements? Even mindfulness? I mean, give me a break. What are you've been telling me to develop mindfulness for years, and now you're telling me it's a problem? You want your money back, probably. And So as the practice develops and there's this concentration and the mindfulness is really strong, the mind gets really clear and works really well, kind of a very healthy, full, clear mind. And so this wonderful mental functionings begin operating. And one of them is this seeing of light. Sometimes people see usually white light, but there are other colors people have. And it can be quite compelling and luminous and feeling of purity. There can be a tremendous sense of knowing. I just know everything. You know things, but it isn't just you know things. The knowing feels like wow, I really know. You know, I'm like, wow, I know everything, you know. Everything's impermanent. Wow, things are changing all the time. Wow, this I know. And a little bit, you know, gets into people's heads. I know. Or the joy just feels so exquisite. The tranquility feels exquisite. The happiness. The faith, the sense of faith is so powerful. It's like we're ready to convert the world. Like everyone should do this. Or the resolve, the determination, like I'm going to sit here, like Buddha said when he was the night of his enlightenment, I'm going to sit here and not move, even if my limbs wither off. I'm determined. Or the mindfulness can seem so clear and crisp, and like everything seems to be just seen and taken in and known, and just like, or the equanimity, just like just everything, you're cool, mellow, just everything is cool, you're good with it all. Or there can be this kind of clinging, kind of a wishing or yearning or longing that people don't quite see it as a kind of holding on or wanting or being attached to. And that last one is the reason why the other nine are defilements. They're not defilements in and of themselves, but the getting attached to those things, holding on to them, interferes, gets in the way of further insight, of seeing clearly. It's getting off track. And it's now, what it is thinking that what the practice is some kind of special experience of joy, of tranquility, of happiness, of equanimity. That's what it's about. And many people are experience junkies. They want, you know, only if they have a good experience is everything good. If they have a bad experience, everything is bad. And their whole sense of self, sense of well-being, sense of purpose, is all measured about whether the experience is good or bad. And having a good spiritual experience, that's what it's all about. But to know the knowledge and vision of what is and is not the path is to recognize that where the path is found is in the knowing of what's happening now. That's where the freedom is found. Knowing is not the same thing as kind of an kind of a global experience like joy or equanimity. Knowing is just knowing. So you can know, oh, equanimity. This is equanimity. Joy arises, we know it's joy. Determination arises, we know it's determination. When things are arising and passing and changing, we know it's arising and passing. When we see there's no self in that, we know there's seeing no self. That there's something about in the knowing, we don't get stuck. The knowing is like Teflon, where we can know, but we don't stop and get stuck, or we don't get attached or cling. And so the whole system can keep flowing. It doesn't get interrupted. There's not a barrier for the flow to keep going. Whereas if we get attached to joy, something actually stops. We're no longer on the path then. We've taken a little detour. If we get lost in the feelings of equanimity, lost in the feelings of, you know, my mindfulness is so strong, or I really know, we're taking a little detour from this step by step, just what keeps staying on the path, ordinary, simple way, keep showing up for the next thing, for this, for this. And then know it well. So if you feel joy, it's fine to feel joy. You know, don't rest in it. Don't, if you're really concentrated and present, don't kind of revel in it. Turn around and know it. And know it well. Where is the joy? What's the sensations of joy? Where's the tingling, the warmth, the lightness? And just see that and be it. See how what the things that make it up, the building blocks of it, are impermanent phenomena, in constant flow of sensations coming and going. And it's the path, what is the path, is the continual knowing of direct experience. What is not the path is the holding on to anything, or almost anything else, is not really the path. That the freedom is found by not from magical thinking, it's not from having crystals, it's not from having a special diet, it's not from getting more exercise, it's not from chanting mantras, it's not from, and oddly enough, you know, wonderfully enough, the Buddha said it's not from being virtuous, but you got to be virtuous, otherwise this doesn't work. But it's not from your ethics. Not your ethics are not the freedom. Concentration is not really the path; it's a foundation for the path. But we step onto the path in the knowing of direct experience, and knowing it directly, clearly. What is not the path is thinking about it. What's not the path is mentally analyzing it. These things all have their place, but as this seven purifications develop, the understanding is you really step on the path, you really have a clear sense of it, when we see so directly, so immediately, so intimately, that we see the arising and passing, the coming and going of the world of of experience. And at first, they give this a name. I love this name. They call it tender vipassana. Tender. I love it. So you're as opposed to strong vipassana. And so this is considered a transition zone. So we're kind of there, but it's not really stable. It's not strong yet. But we really start beginning kind of to feel or sense or be with this the fleeting and permanent nature of the direct experience that we have. The unself-conscious experience. The experience which we don't insert a lot of self into it. Where we allow reality to be as it is. And reality shows itself in its most fundamental forms, arising and knowing, coming and going. So this is a tender vipassana. And then tomorrow, Brian will take us into strong vipassana, which is a little different form, this unfolding of the inconstant nature of experience, the arising of passive experience, which is kind of the hallmark of this practice as we settle in, come closer to home, closer to just arriving and being here. And the process of simplification, just here.